welcome to the Tortoise Shack Sunday special. This is our weekly get together with some of the hosts from the Tortoise Shack stable, and we discuss events of the week, some of the stories that slipped under the radar, and we try to go into a few topics in a bit more depth. I'm joined, unfortunately, by my co-host on the Echo Chamber, Martin McMahon, who we still can't, Martin, this is going on too long now.
I know. Getting up in the morning at 12 on a Sunday. None of you people real lives, seriously.
We'll move on. Caroline West from Glow West is here. Caroline, you've an episode coming out tomorrow. Do you want to tell people?
I do, actually. This amazing young sex educator called Karishma, and we're talking about busting all the myths around sex, because I've spent 2 weeks teaching like 1,000 college students and all the myths that are there because their sex education is so crap. So tune in and you can hear why wearing 2 condoms is not better than 1, and all the lovely things that we sometimes, and why I grew up believing that some people use crisp packets as condoms. Don't do that.
See, this is where you come here for the information that you don't get elsewhere, folks. Also joined by Linda Hayden from the Pack Woman podcast. And Linda, your podcast from this week is out this morning with Evie Nevin.
Yeah. She's fab. And if there's any sock dems in the audience, please give her your number 1 for party chair.
I know you're not supposed to be political. Look, do have a listen. It's a really good conversation. Goes a good bit. Goes a lot broader than anticipated, to be honest with you. Anyway, look, as I said, if you want to come to these events, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. You sign up, you become a member, and you get the link in your inbox. You get a few more emails than you probably planned for, but I'm working on that. I'm doing my best. Nonetheless, look, there's a couple of things we've been asked to box off before we start. And one that's important is the Mother and Baby Homes report, and the fact that it is next Friday is the day that it's going to be closed if we don't get an extension to it. And it is crucial that we do try at very least raise hell between now and then. I know the Sock Dems themselves have decided to use their time to put it on the floor of the Dáil to push for it. But the last time we had anything that made any difference is when people let their TDs and their local representatives know all about it. So we're going to add to the blurb of this the link to Maeve O'Rourke's idea how to do it. Please have a look at it. Please take the time. It's a couple of minutes, but we can't have this sealed now. We can't have this closed now. It's just not good enough to compound injustice on top of injustice, on top of trauma, on top of intergenerational trauma. I spoke to Maeve before we came on air, and she's delighted that people are engaging with this so well. But please, you know, talk to people, make sure that they all do their little bit. We do need everybody to raise hell on this. Sorry, Caroline, you wanted to say something.
No, it's just also a chance to break the habits that we have in Ireland and the silence and shame and stigma. Like, you know, these opportunities don't come along all as often as we would like them to be. So if we're stealing things, like we're still being the same old Ireland that we've always kind of been, and we're hiding the things that we've done to women in this country. So this is an opportunity to create a better society in Ireland. So it is important.
I won't labour that. That's the point. I just want to actually go very quickly into our first topic, and it is back to We Can Be Zero. It's zero COVID, and we're joined by Julian Mercel, who's member of the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group, and he has come up with a green zone plan that he's going to just give us a quick heads up on, Julian, if you don't mind, because we hear often so many times that these things can't happen now, and yet we're looking into 9 more weeks as it stands at a level 5 or a level 4 plus or whatever phraseology they're going to put on it. How do we not squander this, and how do we actually make it work?
Yeah, well, the green zone strategy, the first thing is that it's not proper to ISAG. It's really just a standard way of dealing with disease that are rampant. It's really to say that it's better to address a country's situation by cutting it up into pieces, into areas. So you have very different areas, like in Ireland, for example, Kerry or Achill Island or Cork are just very different from Dublin, right? And it doesn't make much sense to say, okay, we'll have this whole strategy for Ireland, and then in 7.5 weeks, everybody will be at zero. It doesn't work like that. Some areas will be zero much more rapidly than others. So like before Christmas in early December, I don't know if you guys know that, but Galway was a few days away from having reached zero cases. So, which wasn't the case for other places, right? So there's no point trying to manage the whole country in the same target or objectives. So what you do is that you try to reach zero in some easy counties, let's say, maybe they have geographical advantages, maybe they're lucky, maybe they have better public health or whatever. And once you have that, you protect it. And that becomes an example. A politician is going to be very hard for Micheál Martin when, let's say, Kerry is at zero to say, sorry, I can't do anything to protect it. I think that, you know, whatever, we'll see what happens, because people will demand, hey, you better not lose that that one again. And people in communities take pride in that. So if in your community you're at zero and your pubs can open or your shops can open, you're not going to let anybody destroy that. So you will call for some kind of policing to manage people who come in and out of that county. And it's the same thing in other countries. We were talking with the German team for, they're called No COVID instead of Zero COVID. And they were saying exactly the same thing. They have provinces in Germany, of course, and they were saying some of them, maybe they have a better government, maybe they have geographical advantages. And they said, we really try to pinpoint the ones that have a shot at getting to zero first so that they can be used as examples and models. Because it's one thing for me to say, oh yeah, New Zealand has it really nice with the rugby. People can say, yeah, okay, whatever, New Zealand, it's really far. But if you say, hey, Kerry has it now at zero, nobody can ignore that. And you can really see how it's done in practice, and you can practice as well. You can say, okay, that didn't work well to police the borders of Kerry, but that worked really well, so let's do that. So you kind of learn from an example. You need to win somewhere, to win everywhere in a country. So that's all it is. It's really just a geographical approach. And I talked in terms of counties, but it doesn't have to be counties. It could be a city, it could be a half a county, it could be a commuting zone, whatever it is, as long as you isolate that zone and you show that it's possible, then you've reached that goal. It could be also with the two islands. I don't know how long you want me to talk, but it could be with Britain.
No, the two island strategy is essentially what the We Can Be Zero people are advocating for, and it would be much more effective, as we know. Like, it would certainly be our shared islands is how it has been expressed to us, and I do think it's something that we need to look at. But in terms of the idea of, you know, areas that are doing well as opposed to, you know, how do we combat it, we're kind of living in just one big bubble at the moment. Is that not fair to say?
I think the population is pretty clued in as to what's going on. Maybe the government's living in a bubble, but the problem, I think, is that to achieve zero COVID or something near there and to stay there, it doesn't happen overnight. It requires a coordinated effort and investing in resources and empowering people everywhere in the country. It's not just like one kingpin at the top. And that kind of national project is not exactly what Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have been built to carry on, to carry out, right? Because it requires resourcing your public health teams everywhere to tell communities, take matters into your own hands, you know, manage your things for what is best for you. And let's just police or manage the borders and the quarantine regime and all of that. So it's much easier for a government that's not really intent on protecting the population, let's say, to just sit back and say, look, we'll do just the minimum so that cases don't come out, you know, too high and all that.
Can I ask you a question, Julian? And I'm going to play devil's advocate on this. The government is relying on vaccines to jab their way out of this. How many lockdowns, taken into consideration all the projections, how many lockdowns between now and next year if you don't do zero COVID? Just give us a rough estimate.
Yeah, I mean, even in the group, it's a bit difficult with the modeling, but you could say now there's new variants, right? So when you open up at 200 cases, let's say within 2 weeks, you can be back in lockdown because it'll spread really quickly. So, I mean, you could talk about what, 3, 4, I mean, again, I wouldn't quote myself on this. I'm not the specialist on this, but it's what's going to happen. It's impossible to open up at, let's say, 200 cases and not have a lockdown very quickly. So, and again, a lockdown, it depends how politicians can tolerate, you know, how many cases they can tolerate. You could have no lockdown, even if you have 5,000 cases a day. If they don't care, they don't care. So if we follow what happens in the past, yeah, I think maybe 3, 4, or even 5. I mean, I'm not too sure, to be honest, about this exact.
Sorry, modeling. Linda, you wanted to come in there.
It's just going to be about. So here's where the issue is. There's been a lack of transparency around the government's dealing with COVID. And in order to have zero COVID, they would have to really push out and educate people on the language around it and, you know, understanding what's community transmission, what's direct contacts and stuff like that. And I think they don't know how to do that. They're so busy with the smoke and mirrors that they don't actually know how to be that level of transparent with the Irish people. And I think that's where the reticence is probably coming from.
Yeah, well, I think they know, but they don't want to.
Can I know, Aman? I know this wasn't why you were here to talk, but can I? I don't know if you saw. You're from Scotland. Have you seen the language and the statements coming out of the Scottish Parliament are a lot more positive in terms of going for a zero COVID approach? Have you picked up on any of that in the last week or so? And first of all, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm kind of pleased you asked me that question because I thought, gosh, I'm going to be this cliche brown guy sitting there in an exotic dress, and I'm here to talk about race and being brown. So I'm glad you've actually asked me something about COVID because it kind of challenges the stereotype. I mean, I don't know. I just sit back and kind of, you know, watch what's going on and kind of seeing that, you know, in Scotland, things are moving quite quickly. You know, I was a bit worried when my mum, who's over 70 in Glasgow, hadn't been vaccinated, and that happened pretty quickly. So I don't know. I was just kind of reading about the fact that the vaccines aren't being rolled out, and then you're kind of hearing that the supply is coming from the EU. So I don't know. It looks like a bit of a game of politics here, but, you know, health is not politics. And I think everybody should have, you know, equal access and make sure that we're all safe.
Yeah, and I think that's what, like, I know Martin, your dad had his first shot yesterday.
He did, and it's such a huge thing. People underestimate how big it is. Somebody said it to me yesterday. If you could bottle the atmosphere in the vaccination centres, it's a joyous atmosphere. But vaccines aren't the panacea. They're not the solution. They're a part of the solution. I'm right about that, Julian, am I?
Yeah, I mean, they're super important. Nobody denies that. But the problem is that, I mean, you've seen it just like me. Since the very beginning, government strategy has been to showcase the benefits of the vaccine, which we didn't even have at that time, you know. And so there's no point in doing anything very elaborate because the vaccine will come and science is amazing and all that stuff. And then the little carrot of a vaccine, it just allows the government to do nothing else, right? But the countries that have beaten COVID so far, none of them has done it with a vaccine. I mean, in the long term, you need a vaccine, but so that's what has happened. And it's a bit difficult because the vaccine issue, you're cut in between two kind of wrong positions. On the one hand, you have to tell the anti-vax people that vaccines are good. So you have to say vaccines are good. But on the other side, you have to say to the government, vaccines are not everything. So vaccines are not that good in a way. So when you say one thing to the other is saying that you're saying the wrong thing.
To use their awful, awful phrase, the vaccine is part of a suite of measures. You know, that's what it is. And it's an awful phrase, but it's true. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Welcome to Business Speak. Look, we will come back to this.
Can I just say one thing on that?
Yeah, please, sir. Please do. Yeah.
I was just thinking on what Linda was saying there. Like, I disagree as well. I think the government could know exactly how to be transparent if they wanted. I think they don't know how to say in a nice way that actually this is what you get for 60 years electing people with no clear ideology that puts people first. Like, I guarantee you, if cattle could get COVID, we would be shut down and it would be gone within a week and a half. And so their problem is they don't know how to clearly say to people, actually, we don't, you're second to business interests and you're second to like fucking Michael O'Leary, who's like a new presenter. You can't turn on the radio, but he's on. So I think they know what, but we've just allowed politicians, and there's no swift recourse ever for politicians. Like there's no repercussions. So I think it's inevitable that the Irish government is dealing with it like this, because they've just been allowed have this kind of like good for business, something, something progress ideology forever. And now it's come home to, they're terrified of taking a decision without like clearing it with, and I hate to sound like such a conspiracy theorist, but without clearing it with business interests. And
well, we only have to look at the level of cases again in meat plants again and again and again, and it continues to happen. And you know, we're not imagining it. It's still outbreaks. It's still happening. It's still in those positions. And you know, it is that case. And I just do, like, I know Oisin is in the crowd and he talks a lot about what's going on in Scotland at the moment. I did hear statements coming through, and I'm sure you heard them as well, Imán, where they said, well, look, just because something is difficult doesn't mean we shouldn't try for it. And this seems to be the mentality that in Ireland that we've missed that. Imán, you might back me up on this.
I just think we're all going through this pandemic and we all are seeking some form of hope. We're all locked down. Our physical and mental strength is wearing every single day. And we just want some hope. We just want something positive. So if that is coming from the fact, if people are saying vaccines, we'll take it. You know, so I think, you know, I'm thinking at the kind of grassroots level for an individual who hasn't seen their family, you know, and putting aside people who are going on holidays and all of this and, you know, kind of thinking about that. This is huge. And I think, you know, we need to see this from an individual to individual basis, because people are in a very bad shape. So any kind of hope that we can offer them, I see that as gold, and long may it last. And we need it from everybody. We need it from all political leaders and everybody to kind of offer us that.
Sorry, Caroline, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's important. And like, obviously, we can be zero COVID is absolutely amazing. But just to bring in on a global basis, the access level of, you know, it's very wealthy, you know, Western countries that are having access to the vaccine straight away. And the problem with that, obviously, is the longer some countries don't have the access to the vaccine, the more it's going to mutate in those countries and move forward. So it is a massive global issue, and things like racism are part of that conversation. So making that overt and naming it, and I know like we're trying to be an island and trying to look at our own stuff, but if we put ourselves in that future plan of like, how are we actually doing this as a global, you know, population of humans who need this, rather than like we're going to look after ourselves as a rich Western country. So we need to be like just like not doing what we've always done, and like colonialism, well, vaccine colonialism is still a thing.
If the world was truly egalitarian, the Western world would be on lockdown while we vaccinate the third world. That's the way it would work.
I think we could talk about this for the entire bloody episode, and we do have to move on, but I'm glad that everybody kind of understands. But I see a lot of people asking in the comments about how do we get the message across. Julian, you're Greens only, you have published a lot of stuff on the ISAG website, and you've shared stuff on We Can Be Zero. Where can people find the details for that?
On the ISAG website, I guess. Or you can just email me.
We've lost Julian. It's okay. So a few weeks ago, we launched a trans podcast hosted by trans people, talking to trans people, and we're delighted to have the guys on board. We were hoping to have someone here today, but it has been a very difficult week for the trans community in Ireland. And Linda, you saw the importation of trans exclusionary radical feminism going on. Do you want to just give us a quick flavour of the week that was?
So yeah, so as well as the tough time that the ladies from Conversate Trans have had, I was doing a podcast this week on online abuse, and I'd spoken to Aoife Martin and was due to speak to another trans person, and they had to pull out because of the level of online abuse they were getting this week. And then later on in the week, we saw an organisation I'm just going to call them an organization, but they're literally two groups who've been trying to import UK transphobia into Ireland. And they set up what they're calling an Irish Women's Lobby Group, which is apparently a coalition of loads of different groups, but there's only really two of them. And there's no transparency on their website as to who they actually are and where they've come from. We've had people look into the website and it's all locked down. You can't see where it's based. It's using an Irish website domain. It's using an Irish web host server. But there is a strong feeling that it is either UK or Scottish based. And it is part of this massive push to try and import transphobia into Ireland, where we've had self-identification with tiny, very few problems since 2015. And we had no problems with it. And there's been an active push to try and import this transphobia into Ireland since 2019, since there was talk of them there having a change to the self-identification laws in the UK. And so we've seen this happening, and now this organization has set up. They're doing an event on the International Women's Day on the 8th of March, which has everything from well-renowned trans exclusionary radical feminists and sex work exclusionary radical feminists to conversion therapists on the lineup. So if you look at it, it's very worrying. They keep trying. We need to keep shutting it down and telling them that it's not welcome here. As I say, we've had very little problems with self-identification in this country. It was probably one of the most progressive laws that we ever brought in. And you know, we stand with our trans siblings. We constantly say it on this show. We have them on as often as possible. And we obviously have the new podcast now as well. But it's
awful, like when you're talking to friends and they're saying, actually, do you mind if I skip today?
Yeah.
Do you mind if I skip today? Because I'm just a bit down. And you're like, it's totally understandable. And it is very hard when they're your friends. And you just think, God, of course it's okay. But, you know, I don't want to have to keep doing this where people do. And it's just...
I had a chat to Aoife Martin earlier this week, as I say, about the online abuse, and that's going to be the Pack of One podcast episode for next week. So do listen in. I've got Aoife and a member of the LGBT community as well talking about online abuse. But the one thing I would say, and Aoife said, us cis people have a job to do, because the trans community is tiny. And when they're faced with a huge wall of these people coming at them, there's not enough of their voices to let them fight their own battles. We have a job to do. It is our job to protect them. It is our job to stand beside them and make sure that we're shouting these people down and telling them, no, go away, we don't want you. So we have a job to do, and we have to do it.
Active allyship, absolutely. And this sounds, now I feel like I am becoming the stereotype of man, because I am going to actually ask you about the difficult week that you encountered in terms of racism that did come up, that did crop up on the basis of events that you, because you've always put yourself forward, you've always been outspoken. We do reference that you are the best dressed man in Ireland, but nonetheless, active allyship. I know I've seen some people give you some really supportive stuff, but there's been a lot of other stuff directed at you that's been very disappointing and hurtful.
Thank you. I was just actually thinking what you just said there, Linda, and I think it's a good place to start by you know, focusing our minds and our actions on the idea that all our inequalities are connected. You know, the issues that people go through when it comes to homophobia, from, you know, from transphobia, from racism to misogyny, they're all linked. And actually, when we start to separate them, that's where we have this disconnect. I think it's been a very rough 2 weeks for racists in Ireland. I know my week's been quite difficult, but I think the racists have had it even more difficult, because in the last 2 weeks, we've had Douglas Week, which was celebrating the legacy of Frederick Douglass, who was here in Ireland. And this week, we've had the Immigrant Council of Ireland's national conference, where you know immigrants or migrants were actually holding the microphone and were you know steering the narrative. I think these issues are something that needs to be talked about even more. When I was asked to present at the opening panel, I raised the question about, you know, we're all here talking about integration in Ireland. What are we integrating into? Right? And my question is then linked to what is Irishness? You know, people keep saying to me, oh, welcome to Ireland and it's great to be in Ireland. And I was just reflecting on this because, you know, I grew up in Glasgow where I heard time and time again that we're all Jock Tamson's bairns, right? That we're all part of this great, you know, camaraderie, that we're all Jock Tamson's bairns. I very rarely hear that here in Ireland. I don't know what the equivalent would be. I know there is Ireland is a nation of a million welcomes, or I think there's a statement like that. But what does it mean? And since I've been here in 2015, I feel that I'm hearing more about what Irishness is from real scary individuals who are telling me what Irishness is. And so I think that needs to be countered. And it needs to also be challenged and critiqued, because I also feel, and this was the second part of my argument at the integration conference, was that since I've been here, I feel that the diaspora is so highly glorified. Yeah. I've never understood this. What is going on? So somebody like Joe Biden, you know, excellent, the politics have shifted in the US, but somebody like Joe Biden is giving us lessons on what Irishness is, as opposed to the Pakistani doctor who works his arse off at the hospital over here, who pays taxes and has made this his home. So that big tent nationalism of Irishness, we need to hear more about it. And I'm not saying for a second that let's exclude the diaspora. I'm just saying we need to cast this tent wider. And how do we do that? We need to ask ourselves more difficult questions. And it can't be up to migrants to come here and to define white people's Irishness here in Ireland, because, oh no, that is unacceptable, right? It's time for white people to explain and be part of this uncomfortable conversation. So I think that's basically what's happened. And so in the last couple of weeks, I think the racists here in Ireland, who again are a very small minority, are absolutely rattled. They're in an absolute tizzy. And, you know, they make all sorts of personal comments about me and how my voice sounds very screechy. I'm really proud of the fact that I sound like a Highland granny. So, you know, stop you. And I will continue to speak loud. And, you know, and I absolutely love being in Cork. And I think for me, being Irish is to actually be able to critique and to question and to agitate.
Well, I don't know. What do you say to that, guys?
I think you're right about the diaspora, that just somebody who's never set foot on the island can get a passport quicker and easier than people who've lived here for years and years, paid their taxes, you know, that have contributed to our healthcare system, to every part of Irish culture. And yet there's somebody whose granny was Irish can get a passport. That really sticks in my craw.
You know, Linda, I was also thinking that we have so many American soaps and, you know, television and film that kind of feed into Irishness in some way. We've got, you know, I lived in the States for 6 years. We have Irish pub. So are you telling me that they are feeding into what Irishness means? And how do you relate that to somebody who is from Nigeria, for example, who has been living in Cork or in Dublin or any other part for 20, 30 years? So why is it that you don't learn from their identity and their roots, but you're really quite happy to learn from somebody who's talking about Irishness in America? Something quite wrong there. And it begins with an R.
Sorry, Martin, one second. Saoirse, did you have a comment? Or I just...
No, I was just going to say, Aman, you were saying we shouldn't exclude the diaspora. I don't know. I've met some Irish Americans who would make a strong case for excluding them. I'm like, you know, you've been gone an awful long time. Maybe no vote for ye, actually. You know, the way there's this whole conversation about Irish Americans get that vote in the presidency? I'm like, no, maybe not. Because, yikes.
I think we're desperate for international validation as well. I think that's a huge part of it. We are so desperate for somebody to say, look, there's Ireland. It's a real colonial hangover, and we don't have that confidence in ourselves to stand alone and say we are a good country. And we also always need somebody to say, oh, look, isn't Ireland great? And they go out looking for it and fishing for it. And in all honesty, I don't think Americans have any idea who our president is, who our Taoiseach is. I don't think we rate very highly at all. And yet we're so desperate for them to recognize us.
But Julian, you're also new to these shores, but not that new to these shores. Do you have a take?
Well, look, I come from Quebec, right, which is a very nationalist place. So I find here the nationalism is downplayed a little bit, even though it's there. I think the American thing is really about U.S. politics. Joe Biden, the only reason why he talks about the Irish, because there's an Irish vote in the U.S. He doesn't give a shit about Ireland itself. And the reason why our newspaper or media talk about anything U.S. as great is because the foreign investment. That I think it's really what it is. And then it gets jumbled up in this identity bullshit because journalists have to talk about something that sounds intellectual or something. But I think it's quite rational, the roots of that, you know. That's kind of how I've always seen it, you know. I remember when Trump was elected, there was it Sean Spicer, his name?
Sean Spicer. Yeah.
Well, the Irish Times had sending their investigative correspondent there to report on what kind of beer Sean Spicer liked, and it was Smithwick's, you know.
Only recently we've had that where you know, we've seen, again, going back to Martin's point of dying to somehow get some sort of validation. You know, we see Irish news platforms saying, sending messages on Twitter saying to the likes of Steve Bannon, hey, Steve, I'm from RTE. Fancy doing an interview tomorrow or whatever, you know, the likes of that. So we've seen that kind of quartering it.
That's a good point. The validation thing, for me, it's funny because I studied in the US before and, you know, the U.S. doesn't ask for validation. There's views, and that's what we'll do. And Ireland, one thing that drives me mad sometimes is always this thing of waiting basically on our knees to know what Europe will do before we move, waiting for this and that. There's always a bigger player. And I understand why, you know, you can't just assume you live in a vacuum or whatever, but it is what it is. But I see it a lot, yeah.
It's needy is what it is. It's just needy.
Let's even look at the Paddy's Day thing. Oh, God, you know, he has to go over. This is really important. No, he doesn't. It's not really important. It's symbolic. It's ridiculous. Stop that.
I think that stuff is just because the president wants an Irish Taoiseach at the parade to get the vote. I mean, that's how I understand it. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think they care much about
it. It certainly is because of, and a lot of that, unfortunately, stems in, again, goes back to white America versus, the actual America that exists in reality now. And that's where we see that polarization. And to go back to Aman's point, that's why, you know, it is creeping. It is creeping is the wrong word. I hate people saying it's creeping in here. It's actually firmly here, and not as widespread as it is perhaps other places, but nonetheless, and going all the way back to Linda's point around our trans people who are our brothers and sisters, our friends, we have to be better active allies. We have to stand, you know, allyship. I'm reminded of what Bernadette Michalski said, Martin, at the conference we were at, when someone said, you know, we need allies. And she said, allies can mean we're just, we're standing with you, but I'm not saying how far behind you I'm standing.
She's an impressive woman, I have to say. I'd be afraid to cross her, honest to God, I would.
She was 21 in the House of Commons when she slapped
Brilliant.
Tory.
Brilliant?
Look, we do need to move on a little bit, and I just want to go to sorry, Linda, I am picking on you again today, but there was more stuff on the IBSA this week, and things have evolved there. Do you want to just give us a quick flavor? And please be quick because we're running out of time.
Yeah, no, that's fine. We had the commencement of the COCO's Law on the 9th of February, which was probably a little bit late. They held on until World Internet Safety Day, which was ridiculous. They should have just enacted it, because we had 35 cases in between when it was signed in by President Higgins and when it was commenced. But what we've seen this week is that there is an assistant commissioner has been assigned to see if any of the photos that were leaked from particularly the Discord server back in November, if any of them have been reshared. Now, I know Megan Sims, who is my very good friend and who's been front and center in a lot of this stuff, has had her photos leaked this week. We're seeing leaks still happening. There was a focus on it this week in the Examiner as well. But this news that this assistant commissioner is now looking after these investigations gives hope that the Gardaí are determined that they're going to bring prosecutions on this. And also we still have the civil case that we're working away on in the background as well. So watch this space.
Yeah, no, in fairness, you guys have so many people putting in Trojan work. And I know there was an article, Aoife Moore had a good article in the Examiner this week, and you were quoted for the work that you and the Victims Alliance are doing. And we do need to keep an eye on this to make sure that things drive on. I am going to, again, quickly just jump on to this week in politics, some of the things that are going to be a little bit more under the radar. And it's great that Saoirse is here, because we saw last week the work plan for the Climate Committee included CETA. And we saw people saying that CETA, you know, needs to be an admission by government that let's pause it for the second time. Now, this time now, let's have it discussed by different committees. How did you feel seeing it on the work plan for the Climate Committee, and how do you is it a good fit for it?
Well, I suppose, first of all, it kind of links in what Martin was just saying there, that even the fact that we're discussing CETA at this hour for no need is this kind of, wasn't it Fine Gael that said, oh, we just want to send out good signals. And it's basically like, please love us. Give us like a pat on the head, even though we don't need to ratify this, or we're not under pressure. We're not the time limiting country in Europe yet at all. I think it's brilliant that it's on the Climate Action Committee. Like when I first heard that they were just putting it on the European Affairs Committee, I thought, well, that didn't sound good at all. And I think it's excellent that it's on the Climate Action Committee. But does anyone know, is there a limit to how many committees it can be on? Like it should be going through Labour, Health, Justice, Housing.
There's probably one or two people in the audience who can answer that question for us, but we'll see. But you're right, it should be in various committees. It impacts employment rights, it impacts obviously the standards, but you're right on housing, you're right on climate. But
I do think, even though, like, so what I imagine this whole thing was, and maybe I'm just being cynical, is that the government will say, okay, well, we're putting it to committees. Oh, look, the committee said it's great. Now we're going to vote for it. I suppose because it's a European trade deal, it's not like the committee is going to come back with recommendations or recommendations to the European Commission or whoever. So it will be just kind of looking at the effects. And I think it buys the Stop CETA campaign time. Because I think no matter what the committees come back and say, like, it is still in everyone's interest to block CETA if they end up going to a vote.
Yeah, and I suppose the concern, again, as someone who has been, we've been campaigning for the Stop CETA from across the podcasts, actually, but the way it's going now, to have it, if we can get the debate, at least if the debate is public, you know, it's important these things are public. And one fear I have is obviously that, for example, that I know the Climate Committee that meets on Tuesday is a private session, and that would worry me. And maybe I'm just being cynical as well. But the idea of it not happening with full scrutiny, with a full oversight, is something.
Not suggesting, Tony, that the Greens would take it off the Climate Action Committee work agenda. That would never happen.
I'm not
Greens in government.
Right. I'm not suggesting it. I will be watching. I will be watching very closely. It is something that I do think people need to be cognizant of, because in effect these committees, they aren't as democratic as we would like them to be. There is ability to remove these things, because ultimately, the same way a government guillotines through a bill, They can just say, well, we've had a little discussion, now we're going to vote. Even though they've lost the discussion, they can still vote it through. So that needs to be much more mindful. Look, we will come back to it maybe in a few minutes, but I do want to, Caroline, can we have some fun? Can we have some fun?
It's going to be a bit rude fun.
Oh.
No, it won't. It won't. It won't. It's my dear long lost estranged brother, Kim and Kanye West, have decided this week that they're going to get divorced. But I think this has led down a little rabbit hole for me, because I love celebrity gossip and things like that. But obviously the nature of celebrity gossip, we're kind of reflecting a little bit more on, and how we talk about people. So, you know, this started like, the Frame and Britney documentary has just been incredible for looking back at how we treat women in the media. And we all know Justin Timberlake is a see you next Tuesday for many, many reasons. But, you know, the impact of a white man over a black woman, and poor old Britney, my love of Britney. My wedding was Britney themed. So one of my weddings. So it was really nice to kind of go through that. And then I looked at the Paris Hilton documentary, and she talked a lot about if her sex tape was released now, was leaked now, and hers was like a genuine leak. Kim Kardashian's was a little bit stage managed and a business kind of moment, or so it goes anyway. But she was just saying like the trauma of that now, and maybe we might not, you know, package that up and sell it as a DVD in, you know, sex shops and things like that. We might actually look at that and go, hang on a sec, like that isn't okay. And then we looked at how Jennifer Lawrence was treated when her images were leaked as well. And now, you know, we finally have Coco's Law over here. But then, you know, Aoife Grace Moore's article is about how some people are just completely ignoring it and they're collecting these images. So it's just a really interesting look at how we're treating famous women. And I don't know if people saw the Lindsay Lohan interview with David Letterman, when he's just like, so what are you in rehab for? Is it coke? Is it alcohol? And she's like, clearly like desperately uncomfortable, and obviously had not agreed to that. But I just think like maybe it's like a furthering of the Me Too conversation, which some people have said is not that's died out kind of thing, but it's, you know, needs to constantly be brought into our conversations and stuff. And I just think like watching Paris on that show saying if my sex tape was released now, it would be totally different. And I would hope that, you know, like even the fact that the language has changed now, we've kind of moved on a little bit from revenge porn, and we're now naming it for what it is, which is image-based sexual abuse, which is a form of sexual violence. So I would hope that the conversation about Kim and Kanye, this is like, there is a point to Kim coming into this, but the fact obviously she has her sex tape. So the media is going to start digging on her and digging into, you know, their relationship and stuff like that. But we can see their racism, like Meghan Markle obviously has experienced like ridiculous amounts of racism from tabloids, and not even just tabloids, actually just pretty much like every form of media out there. So it's just an interesting reflection on women, sex, race and popular culture. And I think, you know, we're maybe, maybe we can use those conversations for like creating consent culture in Ireland anyway, on a deeper kind of level. So that's my little circular rant about my dear brother Kanye. But
Caroline, you're dead right on the consent piece, and this is the biggest thing that's run through it all. Mm. You have people who are maybe experiencing mental health issues, maybe as a result of trauma, and you have these things that are going on that are perpetuating that trauma, and so you get an acting out when they feel like they're spiraling out and there's no control of the likes of Kanye West and Britney Spears, and even to a certain extent, because Paris Hilton's documentary very much focuses on the abuse that she and others experienced in a school that she was put in. So you see these things, and when you get the context behind them afterwards, you kind of go, oh my God, like when you look at how they were treated when they were in the worst of how they were experiencing their trauma, and it was being played out. And Lindsay Lohan, the same. So, you know, there is a trauma element that runs through all of this. And if you think about all of the stuff that happened to them without their consent, the consent thing is a perpetual issue. If we do one thing, it's about making sure that kids from the age of 2 or 3 understand every element of consent, whether that's about touching another person, doing something to that person without asking them first, or talking about them, or anything like that. If we can get that embedded, that will solve an awful lot of this.
And understanding that it's okay to have mental health struggles. That's literally part of being human.
Sorry, man, you wanted to come in there.
As you were talking about that, I just remembered in Pakistan in 2016, there was a media star, Kandil Baloch, and she was killed by her brother. And she basically, you know, there's actually a book written about her. And, you know, she became this kind of social media star. And there's a book now written by Sanam Mahar on A Woman Like Her, the story behind the honor killing of a social media star. And it's just, you know, and Pakistan was outraged by this. And, you know, it's very easily to fall into the narrative that, oh, yeah, we just expect this in Pakistan, you know. But, you know, you very quickly heard a very strong narrative from Pakistani women and men and, you know, from society to say, no, she had every right to do what she was doing, and this was just unacceptable. And it started a completely new, well, not completely new, but it started a conversation. And I think it's so important to do that, to empower people to, you know, be able to do what they want, but make sure that they hold the power to that narrative, they hold the power to what they want to do. And I just, you know, every time I hear something that's, you know, like the news here, I always think, you know, I always try to find an example of what's happened from where my parents are from in Pakistan. And I always try to find who is it that's speaking up, who's speaking up for human rights, and who are the key people in Pakistan who are doing that. And I feel really full of hope. And it's really horrible to kind of see that. But, you know, the Kandil Baloch's example was horrible. She died because of that, and her brother killed her. And it's kind of complicated with honor killing. But, you know, the voices that have emerged after that are just amazing. And, you know, we learn from that, hopefully in some way.
Man, we've seen this week as well, Joe Duffy and the pearl clutching over the OnlyFans piece. And again, Megan Sims was on the show. But there was like all of this kind of equating it. There was a huge element of slut shaming that was going on with OnlyFans, but only to the women who were engaging in the OnlyFans. When Claire Byrne had the guy on, it was like, oh, fair play to him, look, he's doing great to provide for his family and all this. Yet the next day on RTE, we had literally Joe Duffy clutching his pearls, saying, oh, you know, it's money laundering for drug dealers and stuff like this. So there is still that dual standard there, even when we're trying to push things forward and talk about people being able to do what they want with their bodies and how they make their money and all that kind of stuff, and reducing the shame around sex work and stuff like that. But we can definitely still see the dichotomy there.
Caroline, I know, but just really quite on
just
time.
Super quick. I just want to just address the comment that's come in there about, yeah, there's lots of exploitation documentaries that are coming out about these things. Yeah, 100%. But the way you solve that is letting people make their own if they want to make their own. So, you know, documentaries about sex work should be made by sex workers, and, you know, podcasts about trans people should be made by trans people. And like, that should be really obvious, but that doesn't happen. But yeah, just mention that before.
No, absolutely. Listen, we are going to wrap, but I wonder now, I've just got to, if anybody has got a hero of the week, can you please let me know now? Because I'm, do you, anybody got Linda, Caroline, Saoirse, Martin, anybody?
I'm tapped out this week, Tony.
I've just watched, like, my hero of the week is, I've just watched this seagull fly with about half a seal, it must be twice its size, and it kept like landing and dragging it and flapping a bit, and he got it up away from all the other seagulls, and it's like it's twice its size, and so he's my hero of the week.
So meanwhile in Ackle, nature has gone.
Nature is healing. Yeah.
Just rub it into us that we're stuck in boring places. Thanks, Saoirse.
Sorry, Linda, did you have
I didn't prep one, sorry.
No, that's fine. Look, Amanda, have you got anybody who stood out for you this week?
Not really. I'm just really grateful. I think my heroes are actually my friends in Cork and my colleagues who actually sent me chocolates.
Oh, I saw that.
I'm really quite pleased to have good friends. They are my heroes.
Go on, Linda. Go on.
Okay, I've remembered. Sorry. I want to give a big shout out to Rooted in Africa in Ireland. For pulling out of a conference of that's arranged by one of the organisations that's taken part in that transphobic conference, and saying that they're not having any dealings with them while they're associating with those people. That's allyship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Look, if you want to come along to these events, they are patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Costs, it's about a fiver a month. You get buckets load of extra content, and you get to hang on for what is about to kick off now is our conversation with some of the people who are in the audience. And we will leave the recording part for that right now. Thank you.